We've been talking about the Christian's worldview, and it's kind of the way that we view everything around us. It's the presumptions that we have whenever anything happens. So for the next several weeks, I'd like to talk about the Christian's worldview as it relates to government and civil authority or human authority. We know that we ultimately have to answer to God, that everything that we do, everything we say, everything we are, ultimately is controlled by God. But we also have to live in a world where we deal with civil government. And I think this is particularly germane to our situation today. We're dealing with civil government, and sometimes the mandates and the regulations and the laws that are enacted mean that we have to carefully consider how we're going to respond. In studying about restoration history, I've been impressed at the way that the folks in the 1800s had to come to grips with the Civil War. Was it reasonable for the Southern states to secede from the Union? How they had to come to grips earlier with the Revolutionary War? Was it reasonable for the American colonies to sever their ties with England? It happened during World War II, happened during World War I and World War II. It happened in Korea, but I don't know as much about what was the case in Korea. And it happened in Vietnam, and it touched me. I registered as a conscientious objector when I had to register for the draft. I've since changed my understanding of my relationship to government and whether I would serve in the military today. But those are questions that we have to answer. We have to do it carefully. You know, our elders have had to deal with what our response was going to be to the state government saying that we could or could not meet, or how many of us could meet together at one time. A lot of different things like that. And I really appreciate the elders beginning with the understanding that we answer to God. Also had to deal with how we're going to deal with the mandates of civil authority. If you ever get a chance, I would suggest reading David Lipscomb's commentary on Romans 13. David Lipscomb was a Southern preacher during the Civil War and had to write about whether or not Southern Christians could take part in the Civil War. James Garfield, on the other hand, was a Northern Christian, served in the Northern Army, and eventually became president of the United States. He, in an earlier part of his life, was a preacher. And they had very different approaches to it. So if you get a chance, it's really instructive, I think, to read what they have written. I can't give you a hard and fast rule to follow, but I can about all I can do is say we need to consider the biblical information. So let's start doing that. And what I'd like to do is talk about the roles that the civil authorities are expected to play. And we establish that by biblical information. And we're going to talk a little bit about the general view of government, and we'll try to understand how God generally views government. And then we'll finish up tonight talking about the role of civil judges. And this was a problem, of course, in Corinth. But let's get back and start thinking about a biblical understanding of the role that government ought to play. Why did God establish government? We constantly talk about how in the garden, God established the family. Later, God established governments. And then finally, God established His church. He also had at one time the theocracy, the Old Testament theocracy, where the church or the congregation of Israel was not only a political entity, but it was a religious entity as well. So from that perspective, then we'll try to understand the role of government. Romans, the 13th chapter, is the passage that we, generally speaking, think about when we think about the role of government. But I want to begin in Ecclesiastes, the 8th chapter. And I don't think we really need to read all the way down to verse 13. That would be the entirety of Ecclesiastes, the 8th chapter. It's an important thing to consider the entire chapter, but I think because our time is limited, I'd like for someone to read Ecclesiastes 8, starting at verse 1 and reading just down through the end of verse 6. Can I get somebody to do that?
Who is like a wise man, and who knows the interpretations of a matter? A man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. Do not be in a hurry to leave him. Do not join in an evil matter, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since the word of the king is authoritative, who will say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. For there is a proper time and a procedure for every delight, though a man's trouble is heavy upon him.
Any thoughts? Well, let me give you a bit of background here. Some have translated this, especially Ecclesiastes 8, chapter verse 2, a little bit differently. Some say that the wise man is saying, I keep the mouth of the king. Some say that it should be translated, I take good heed not to meddle with state secrets, and if I know, to hide them. Or, I obey the commands of the laws. I feel myself bound by whatever the king has decreed. And then this phrase, in regard to the oath of God, it appears, at least in my mind, that this is a passage that is of particular importance for princes. And during the Old Testament period of time, and we're talking David during the unified kingdom, the princes, the minor civil authorities, took an oath of office, or they pledged their obedience to the king. And this oath, this pledge that he refers to, the in regard to the oath of God, this was a pledge that was made in the presence of God. And so he's saying, you've made this oath. It happened with David, 2 Samuel 5, verses 1 through 3. It happened with Joash, 2 Kings 11, 17. It happened with Solomon, 1 Chronicles, the 29th chapter, at verse 24. So what are your thoughts here in Ecclesiastes 8? What do you see the wise man saying? Carol, can you repeat what she said? I have trouble hearing it.
She said verse 1 demonstrates respect for the government.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else? Why do you think that we need to keep the king's commandment?
Lee says because it's established by God, but it's the same thing. You have to understand authority. In order to understand God's authority and obey God, you must be willing to obey the civil authority, or the husband God's authority, and the wife the husband's authority, and the children the authority of the parents.
Okay. So it's the king's authority is illustrative of the kind of authority that God has. Good point. What else do you see here? What about this phrase in verse 5? And I'm reading from the American Standard. He says, whoso keepeth the king's commandment shall know no evil thing. Then he says, a wise man's heart discerns time and judgment.
Discerns what, Dean?
Discerns time and judgment in the American Standard. Lenny's read a little bit differently there at the end of verse 5. Lenny, how does yours read at the end of verse 5?
It says, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure.
Okay. What's the proper time? What's he talking about? A wise man knows the proper time and procedure.
Dean, if you have an objection to the what the king is saying, there's a proper time and the wisdom to keep your mouth shut and maybe not, if you're doing what God says, you're looking for the proper time. You're just not going to throw down the challenge thing to the king, you're going to wait and see what the proper time for the judgment is.
Okay.
Maybe it goes back up to verse 3. I don't know.
Go ahead. Expand that a little.
Well, do not be in a hurry to leave him. So you're choosing your time and your procedure, and do not join in an evil matter, because the king's going to do whatever he wants to do. So you have a decision to make.
That's interesting. The king's going to do what he wants to do, and you have a decision to make, whether you're going to or obey it or not. But he does, I think we've hit on an important thing. There's a right time and a wrong time to make your argument. And a right way and a wrong way to make your argument. I don't know that I can always say, I don't know that I'm always wise enough to know when it's the right time to make the argument. I tend to run off at the mouth, which doesn't serve me well.
Dean?
Yeah.
It seems to me that you were talking about the two people who are being persecuted and taken to court over things that they posted about what God has said in Finland.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the proper time and place, if I was the rest of the Christians who were Finland, I'd go out and I'd rally and I say, if you arrest them, this is how many of the rest of us you have to put in jail. So get ready, because we're all going to jail because we're not going to do what you say. And I think that if they stood up now, the court would decide otherwise.
That's interesting. One of the things that article that I didn't talk about this morning, but one of the things that is happening is Christians throughout Finland and even throughout the rest of Europe are responding, pledging their support to the individual who has been arrested, which is kind of what Carol is saying. It unfortunately is true that sometimes if you take it upon yourself to stand up and say, I can't do this, the Christians will desert you. Right? It happened to Paul. He was arrested. He's taken before the Roman authorities. He says, everybody's left. So he writes to Timothy and he says, bring me the books and the cloak. I've largely been deserted. But I think like Lee said, we have to respect those that are in a position of authority. They are going to do whatever they want to do. Okay.
I always looked at it not respecting the person in that position. I respect the position that person is in.
Okay. And how does that play out?
Yeah. Well, just think back of the time of the draft. You had a president in there who was all for big business. And that's why the Vietnam War kept on going, to keep businesses going. And you had to make a choice. I respect the office of the president. I didn't respect the man.
Yeah. There's a lot to be said for that. I respected the role that the military played. I didn't respect the way that they, that I didn't respect that they were fighting an unjust war. So that was the way that I kind of understood that. Let's look at Deuteronomy 25. And good point, Lenny. Deuteronomy 25, verses 1 through 3.
If there is a dispute between men and they go to court and the judge decides their case and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall make him lie down and be beaten in his presence with the number of stripes according to his guilt. He may be beaten 40 times, but no more, lest he beat him with more stripes than these, and your brother be degraded in your eyes.
What do you see here?
Again, that's authority that says that it no more than 40 times, and you get dishonor if you just continue to waylay him. You lose the honor, you lose the disrespect.
Okay. Does the government have the responsibility to choose or to judge controversies between individuals?
Well, that's what Moses was told, was to choose men to hear the judgment of the people. Then people don't have the wherewithal most of the time to settle their situations.
Right. Good point. So that if the government is not exceeding its biblical role when it makes judgment in the case of controversy, that's on the assumption that the government decides on the basis of facts and not just, well, I like Jerry and I don't like Lenny, so whenever Jerry and Lenny can't get along, Jerry's always going to win. Just because I like Jerry, he's a better guy than Lenny. That's not the role of government. What does it say here about how government, how civil authorities have to look at the people that they are governing?
They justify the righteous and condemn the wicked.
Good point. Good point. The, you know, our system of courts operates basically to punish the evildoer. And if, and so in our system of justice, everything revolves around knowing that you have the evildoer. In the Jewish system of government, I understand, and I, you know, of course I didn't live then, but the Jewish system wasn't built on the same presupposition. The Jewish system was to reward the righteous. And that's different than punishing the wicked. So you go to court not to prove that you're innocent. You go to court to prove that what you did was right. Just interesting. And I've thought a lot about that. And I've talked to some attorneys about how that's going to color what happens in court. I saw it very interesting in the end of verse 3. He says, if you give your brother more than 40 stripes, that was the limit. Would give him as many as 40 stripes, and the Jews always stopped at 39 because they didn't want to take the chance of going over. Okay. But the reason that he says that you do that is that if you exceed 40 and you just beat the poor man, who's the guilty man, if you just beat him mercilessly, then he becomes vile in your eyes. And God never wanted the government to view the subjects as vile. You can view them as doing something evil, but that's different than viewing them as vile. Okay, let's read Romans 13, verses 1 through 7. This is a passage that we're most familiar with when we think about the responsibilities and the function that government is supposed to serve.
I can read that.
Go ahead.
Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid. For he does not fear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore all to their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor.
Okay. I'll tell you the way that most people have viewed Romans 13 in light of the Southern states seceding from the North in the Civil War. In verse 3, he says, rulers are not supposed to be a terror to good work, or rulers are not a terror to good work. In verse 4, he says, he is a minister of God to thee for good. Wherefore, if you do evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain. He is a minister of God, an avenger for wrath to him that doeth evil. And David Lipscomb and some others in the South argue that if the government, to which I owe obedience, is not doing this, but instead is oppressing me, then I'm not called upon to give obedience to an oppressive government. I'm called upon to give obedience to a government who is in fact serving the good. And sometimes, in the American Revolutionary War, the colonists said, we owe allegiance to the King of England. We have sworn to give him allegiance. He is doing what is good for us. He's God's minister. But then he stopped doing what's good for us, and his purpose was to oppress us. So we're released from God's commandment to give him obedience. What do you think? Anybody else?
Maybe that's the time and procedure.
Could be. Could be. That the time has nothing to do with protecting yourself by choosing a good time, but when the government steps outside of the role that God expected the government to serve, then you don't owe obedience. That's interesting. Now, you have to remember, there's probably never been a more oppressive government than the Roman Empire. But the early Christians were told, pay your taxes to Caesar. You still owe him your taxes.
Dean?
Yeah.
It seems to me that the further the area that the ruler rules, the further you get away from the king's authority. So in Rome, the Caesars ruled and knew everything that was going on, and it was all done by their authority. By the time you get out to the provinces, yes, they are doing and saying what God wanted you to do, but the tax collector added his extra thumb on, and the provincial governor did the same sort of thing. So now all of a sudden it's not necessarily what the king is doing, but what is being done in his name, supposedly.
Okay, by corrupt civil authorities. Good point. And I think there's some sense in which this impacts our response to vaccine mandates and masking mandates and all of the things that the government is doing now. I think in the beginning, it was pretty clear that nobody knew how to respond to COVID. And so the civil authorities took steps based on the best understanding that they had in order to protect the public. And it may be that they stopped protecting the public and they just have mask mandates and vaccine mandates and all kinds of regulations and rules that don't make any sense just because they can make rules. And that's a very different thing. There was an article published about 3 weeks ago in that area. It ran in the Atlantic, which is it's a political magazine, but you know, understand what the Atlantic is. It's not an official organ of the federal government. But the title of that title of that article was "Mask Mandates Don't Need to Make Any Sense," and that, I think, may be the point at which we've crossed a line. And we've been very careful at Coburg Road to do everything we could within our power to abide by the requirements that civil authorities laid down. You know, need to limit the number of people that you put into your building, that you need to wear masks when you're in a public assembly. We didn't do it just because the civil government said to do it, but we did it because the elders looked at the available information and said, yes, they are doing what they're doing to try to protect us. And so we think we ought to give them the respect that they're due, and we ought to follow what they say. And it may be that we've gotten beyond that. I don't know the answer to that. Our political system is so fractured that sometimes it's hard to get at what's really true and what's not true. But yeah, as in the Civil War, you know, remember the entire economy of the South was built on agricultural labor, slave labor, and the value of all of those slaves exceeded the total value of manufacturing, all of the assets of manufacturing in the North. And the North said, you can't have those slaves. So, you know, from a certain perspective, you have to say that the South said, wait, you're just taking more assets than you're taking the most valuable asset in the whole country, and you're telling me I have to give it up, and you're not willing to compensate me for that. So those are just a lot of things to think about.
Dean, that's that same sort of thing of devaluing the person when you call it an asset. Listed in the column of an asset. It's a person.
True.
So that's where the problem comes.
That's true. That's true. Of course, in a factory, you also consider factory workers an asset. And when I sell, you know, people make a big, and I'm not defending slavery. Understand, I'm not defending slavery. But when you sell a factory, you sell all of the employment contracts that go with the factory. So you're selling not just the tools, not just the buildings, but you're selling the people that work there. Now, was it different in the South? Absolutely, it was different. Absolutely, it was different. But just simply to say that the South treated a human being as an asset is no different than saying the North, or manufacturers or factory owners in the North, treated individuals as assets. And they were bought and sold. That's not something that's generally argued as a part of this discussion. And I don't mean to get into a defense of slavery. I really don't want to do that. But I do try to understand why the South felt like they were justified in seceding from the Union. And remember, there were a lot of Christians that fought on both sides of this war. There were a lot of Christians in the South who said, I can't fight in the war at all. There were a lot of Christians in the North who said that I can't fight at all. I am not going to go and kill my Christian brother for any purpose. I'm just not going to do that. And people were bitterly divided about Christians serving in the military. In the North, a lot of Christians served in the military and served in positions of command. James Garfield future president of the United States, was a commissioned officer in the Northern Army. In the Southern Army, many times Christians refused. They were willing to fight in the army, but they were unwilling to accept positions of command. So it's just not an easy question. Let's look at 1 Peter 2. I'd like to get through all of these passages tonight, if we can. 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 17. Can I get somebody to read that?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm doing this on a different thing, so I don't know. 13 through 17.
Mm-hmm.
Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king.
Again, notice here that the role of government that we're told to submit to is to execute vengeance on the evildoers and praise to them that do well. So we need to submit to a government that does that. The question is, do we have to submit to a government that doesn't do that?
I would say the question always also has to be the definition of good.
Okay, expand that.
Because the government sometimes defines good or right or truth as something we know to be false. For instance, our government defines homosexuality as good or right or truth and defends it. That's not something that we can support in God's word.
Okay. Good point. And I think it's legitimate to say that sometimes civil authorities view themselves as having the position of God and able to decide right and wrong. I think the Romans did. I think clearly that's what's going on in Finland. And I think it's also true of what's happening here. People in the medical community are being told that they have to perform surgical procedures that they see as wrong. They see as contrary to what God describes as truth. And the question is, do we have to, just because the government says you have to do this, do we have to do it? Anybody else? It's a good comment, Deb. Well, let's look at Deuteronomy 17. That was my chair. That wasn't me. I realize that I'm over 70, but that was my chair. Let's look at Deuteronomy 17, beginning at verse 8. and read down through verse 12. And this is a time that I think it was Carol made reference to Moses appointing judges.
If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, and between one kind of assault or another, being cases in dispute in your courts, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. And you shall do according to the terms of the verdict, which they declare to you from that place which the Lord chooses. And you shall be careful to observe according to all that they teach you, according to the terms of the law which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they tell you, you shall do, and you shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you to the right or the left. And the man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest who stands there to serve the Lord your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel.
Stern warning, isn't it? And again, I think this is, the presumption is that the judge, the priest, is going to judge according to the law of God and according to the facts. What would happen to the priest or the judge who judged for money, who became corrupt? We've seen that over and over as we've looked at the Old Testament prophets. Judges started judging for money. What did God say to those judges?
I would say that their result would be the same as the person who did not do as the righteous judge said. It would cost them their life. And regularly did, as I remember, with all of the kings and judges who fell away from God.
Okay. In some cases, God even caused them to be put to death. Good point. Let's conclude with 1 Timothy 2.
I can read that. First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for all men, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life, godly and respectful in every way. This is good, and it is acceptable in the sight of God our Savior.
So what do you see as the important idea here?
Pray for our leaders.
Go ahead, Eileen.
Pray for our leaders that they will do the right thing according to God.
Okay. Ron, you had a comment.
I was just going to say the same thing, so that we might have a quiet and peaceable life. That's what we all desire and what God desires for us.
Okay. And that's why he established civil government. I think that there's a part of this that says, pray for them because this is not an easy job. It's not always easy to figure out how to lead a family. And goodness only knows that sometimes we make the wrong decision. It's not easy to lead a church. And so we need to pray for people who are in that position. It's not, I know it can't possibly be easy to be a judge. Can't possibly be easy to be the governor or a senator or the president. So we need to be praying for them. That they have the wisdom to do the job the way God wants them to do the job. So that I think there's a biblical role for government. And I put this in because I think it's important for us to understand that that the job that they're called upon to do is a hard one. And I know, I joke all the time with Kim. I could solve all the problems of the world if they just make me king. But they're not going to do that. So I don't get to solve all the problems because goodness only knows I'm the wisest man around. Notwithstanding the fact that I've made all kinds of mistakes. But it's not an easy job.
That's why God helped Moses, because he was having a hard time taking care of everything, so God appointed help for him.
Good point, Lee.
And if you think about David, he blew it, even though he had a heart that was like God's. And Solomon, the wise, sounds to me like he blew it too, so it's not very easy.
That's true. It's not an easy job. There are people that do it very well, and they agonize over the decisions that they make. And I know that the elders here have agonized over the decisions that they've made about how the church ought to respond to civil government and what that looks like. Well, we didn't get as far as I wanted to get tonight, but that's okay. We don't have a time that we have to finish. We'll just keep thinking about these things. It's important enough that we spend the time thinking about them. Any other comments before we get away? Thanks to everybody for all of their input.